Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. This is the first talk after my annual two-week little retreat in my cave. I always value those times of silence, seclusion, just focusing and dedicating just to meditation with hardly any interference at all, just minor little bits and pieces in the morning, but hour after hour, day after day, of just being in a little cave, meditating. It's really good fun. There's a cat there or something. Okay. Very good. And, of course, you have a wonderful time, a lot of peace, a lot of insights, and just generally, just the understanding the attitude of how to meditate and how to live your life. Because there's hardly any difference between what you do in seclusion or what you do when you're working for others or when you're teaching or whatever. And to bring it into focus this morning, just going over to the retreat center site and talking with our builder. And he was saying to all the other of his workers, how you should be strict with everybody, and you should tell these subcontractors what you need, and don't let them sort of give you anything back which you don't want. You know, you're the bosses, and you should be fierce and stuff like that. He said, that way we'll let Ajahn Brahm be happy and get his retreat center finished in time. And I just 2 or 3 days out of a retreat, I said, it doesn't matter when it's finished. It's finished when it's done. And of course, he was quite taken aback by that. Because I was just so cool and so, whenever things happen, when it's done, it's finished, and that's okay. Because that's what happens when you come out of a retreat. Things become in perspective, everything's nice and peaceful and calm. When these things happen, get done, they'll get done. You don't sort of focus on the unimportant things in life. So often that people have the wrong priorities in life. What's really important? When you've had some deep meditation and your mind is very peaceful, what you really thought was important uses all priority. And there's other things which are more important. And you all know what those things are which are much more important than getting things done. And those things which are more important are the peace, kindness, gentleness, compassion, stillness, the gentleness and the beauty of Buddhism. Especially monastic life, especially meditation monks and nuns. We always remember what we're here for. We're not here for building retreat centers. That's something which we just do, just almost like as a part-time, even though it takes a lot of hours. But the main reason we're here is just for those beautiful, peaceful, calm states. That's what we're here for. And so having spent 2 weeks enjoying those things, it's very easy to keep your perspective right of what we're here for, what we're supposed to be doing, and why we're supposed to be doing it. And once you have the goal and what we're here for very clearly in your mind, you're mindful. Mindful also means remembering these things, keeping them in mind. You remember what you're supposed to be here for. The whole way of practice, the whole way of talking, the whole way of eating, the whole way of sweeping or going to the toilet becomes very clear. Because sometimes you have things like the Satipatthana Sutta where it says you should be mindful walking, mindful laying down, mindful going to the toilet, mindful eating and everything. But that doesn't mean just knowing what you're doing. It also means knowing why you're doing it, what the purpose of this is for. But always keep in mind the purpose of monastic life, what we're here for. And when you keep the purpose in mind for, then you're not like the builder anymore, sort of scolding people and telling people what they should be doing. You're just this person who has peace and kindness and encourages other people to do the very best for you. You motivate people to work hard rather than order them to work hard. And motivation is what is the greatest source of power, you know, in the path of meditation. That motivation comes from faith and wisdom. You know, you have the faith in this great Buddhist teachings. You know, you understand what it's, you know, from the people you've met, from the examples you've seen, you know, what this path is there for. These beautiful, peaceful, calm, quiet sages, you know, get always unruffled, even in the hardest situations. The silent ones, the calm ones, who don't need very much in the world, who can just be perfectly content and happy with hardly anything at all. Those ideals you keep in mind. And you've seen those types of people, and they motivate you to go on that same path of calmness, of stillness, of simplicity, when life like loses all its complications. Ah, just the world argues, said the Buddha, with him, but he doesn't argue with the world. It's a beautiful little saying there. So just the world does this and the world does that, but he just accepts that that's how the world is. He doesn't argue with other people, he doesn't argue with the world. He makes peace with it, he's calm with it, he's gentle with it. And by example, he motivates others to follow in his footsteps. Doesn't force people or shout at people to meditate. Just sits there quietly in the peace, the kindness, the beauty. That's what really motivates people to become Buddhists and do the same. And so that motivation is what we use in our daily life. It's also what we use in our meditation. Sitting hour after hour after hour. You know, why on earth don't you get bored? You don't get bored because you motivate yourself. You motivate yourself out of inspiration, out of wisdom, just to do the right thing. Do the right thing. I don't mean just doing the right thing because you're a goody-goody monk, but the right thing which leads to peace, which leads to happiness, which leads to freedom. That's why you meditate for. And a long time ago, you realize you don't meditate to get into jhanas, you don't meditate to get enlightenment. You meditate for the sake of peace, for stillness, for letting go, for emptiness, for freedom. That's what you meditate for. When the goal is very clear, the meditation takes off. A lot of time that I've talked here, that you don't get any progress on the path through willpower. The willpower just leads to a bigger, stronger ego. Because it's the will which feeds the ego, and it's the ego which supplies the will. Instead of using willpower, you always use wisdom power. And wisdom power is such a beautiful way of meditating. You have motivation, you have understanding and wisdom. So you look at what needs to be done. You know intuitively sometimes, you know, you have enough experience, you're wise enough to know how to deal with things. And just the way that it works in meditation, that's the way it works in daily life. Sometimes you just leave it alone. The more I leave my mind alone, the easier it gets still and peaceful. Same with the monks in a monastery here. You know, my job was just to give you the huts, make sure there's enough food and robes for you, and to give enough teachings, and off you go. So you just free people and motivate them, encourage them, trust them to do the right thing. And of course, you know, I was just saying the other day to somebody, they were asking how the monks were in this monastery. I said, amazing monks in this monastery this year. Oh, it was actually to Wai Lun, that's right, he rang up. And so really, really good group of monks this year. And by saying that, I was being quite honest, that you know, you motivate people, and monks have been meditating hour after hour, staying in their huts, doing good things. So it's wonderful to have that. You don't have to force people. Just encourage, give them opportunities. And most people, especially people in Western countries who became Buddhist monks or nuns, are so highly motivated already, otherwise they wouldn't make it to be a Buddhist monk or a nun. The very fact they've got this far means they've got enough motivation. All you need to do is give them facilities and off you go. But give them the facilities and give them the opportunity, but also to encourage people, please don't go into the willpower and being a control freak. Because it's the control freaks, you know, like the builder. Yeah, maybe get the building done, but there's no love in it. You know, it gets it done fast, but it hasn't got the same feeling of everybody being happy with it. You know, sometimes the process how it's done is more important than what gets done. So by following the process and having a nice, happy, calm, beautiful process, it may take longer, but still, the way it's done will affect the energy of that place. It's the same the way you meditate, the way you live in a monastery, the way you eat. So not so much what you eat, but how you eat depends whether you get stomachache or whether you get healthy. So how we eat and how we work and how we meditate and how we sleep. And the how business is where wisdom comes up. And it's the how we meditate. And we meditate just to make peace, to be free, to be calm, to be still. And you know that word stillness has been a favorite word over the last couple of years. You know, my preferred rendering for samadhi, not concentration, not one-pointedness, but stillness of mind. So I always remember that when I meditate, be still. And to be able to be still, it takes a lot of wisdom to be still, to be able to let things go. Just today, talking with some visitors here, and they were saying, oh, we can't meditate. Every time I sit down, I think I should be doing the ironing or the cleaning or something else. And that's what it's like in the lay world. They really think that they should be doing these things. You know, they're owned by their housework or by their jobs or by these other things which we have. And the point is, you don't need to do that. All these things which we think we have to get out of the way before we can get enlightened. Now get enlightenment out of the way, first of all. You can clean the house afterwards. Of course, that's a difficult thing for a person to do. But if you look at all the activity, why you do things, you know, sometimes you look, it's not really necessary. So why do I do it anyway? You can see why you do it. The source of such restlessness, there is this sense of self which will not let go. It always wants to do something, because when you're doing something, that's when you exist. That's when the self makes its identity. And when you don't do anything, the sense of self has to disappear. And sometimes we stand our ground and we shout at other people. And where is that coming from? It's only coming from one place. It's coming from the sense of ego and sense of self. We think we want to do something and make it better. It has a sense of compassion and kindness, really wanting to do something well in this world. But be careful there. Along with the sense of righteousness is a huge amount of self and ego involved. And when you actually see that, you think, oh, just what am I doing this for? It's not what I became a monk or a nun or an anagarika for. So you came an anagarika, a monk or a nun, for the sake of peace and stillness, for the settling of things. And sometimes the way to settle things is not to settle what's outside. Because outside, the world outside, is just, that's the way it always is. People say things, people do things. The crows, they make that particular crow noise, the ka-ka. That's just what they're like. You can't stop them doing that. The kangaroos, they bounce around. They have their flies come buzzing around, they're coming out now. That's just what these things do. The same as people. People say stupid things, that's what people are like. They do stupid things. But I don't get upset at the crows. Just let the crows do what they have to do, let the flies do what they have to do. When you actually make peace with things, it means that you're not sort of paying so much attention to the outside world. You're paying attention to the inner world, how you're relating to things, how you're responding to things, what you're doing about things. And that's the most important thing to relate to, how you're behaving. When you know how to behave, how what you're doing with things, then it makes it much easier to even to meditate. Because what we're actually doing, we're meditating in order to be still. And that stillness, you can't make the outside world still. You have to make this inside world still. So a lot of times when I meditate, you sit down and you just watch the doer. You watch this thing, you know, which is always initiating stuff. Planning, complaining. And when you can actually notice that doer, you know, the will, the controller, this important aspect of the self. Spend a lot of time just calming that down. Stop doing the meditation. Stop trying to get things or get rid of things. And stop being active. So in meditation, you become this incredibly passive observer. By putting attention not so much on your meditation object, it doesn't really matter so much whether you're watching the breath, whether you're watching Buddha, or whether you're watching a casino, or you're watching loving kindness. The object is not so important as how you're watching this thing. So you put a lot of attention just on this thing inside, which is doing the meditation, and calming that thing down. Because when you calm the doer, this is the source of the restlessness. When you can look at that and get this mindfulness, this awareness, this perspective of this thing behind everything. What the Buddha called the householder, the sankhara, the chetana. When you can get behind that and see what it is, it becomes much easier to calm things down and to really meditate properly. So I spent a lot of time in my retreat just being still. And when you achieve any state of stillness, it doesn't matter if you can call it jhana or it's just seeing nimittas or you just have a beautiful breath, when you become a sense of stillness, understand what stillness is, feels like. When people experience states of stillness, it gives like a validity, a reality to what this path is all about. Because whenever there is stillness, there's contentment. The sense of fullness, of completeness, of an ending of a journey. That's where you rest. Like the classic tale of going on a journey, at the end of the journey you go to the inn or the hotel where you can stop and rest at night. Where you can be still, where all your travelling and all your journeying is over. And that's what meditation is like. Meditation is the hotel, the inn at the end of the journey where you can stop, where you can rest and be still, where you don't have to journey, to walk, to run, to do, to make, to perform anymore. It's where all that finishes. So that stillness is something which is important to understand, to realize through your own experience, what it's like to be even a little bit still. And the beauty and the pleasure of that stillness. Get into it and see how still you can be. Because from that stillness, you get enormous amounts of joy and happiness. Sometimes, there's always this sense of restlessness in people's meditation. They're always trying to get deeper and further, the next attainment, the next stage. That degree of restlessness there in this particular part of meditation, it needs to be noticed. Just like the builder, let's get it done quickly. It's like a coarse form of restlessness. But the builder inside of you trying to complete the task early or on schedule, on your schedule, whatever schedule there is. That's actually the same defilement there. It's just the cause of this restlessness and the inability to go deeper. Whenever you get to any stage of stillness, all it means is you've got to let go a little bit more. And what do I mean by letting go a little bit more? Not letting go of the object, but keeping a bit of mindfulness on this doer, on how much that you want to try to get this stillness to change and become something more profound. How that you always want to go onto another stage, to go deeper to get more. People are become monks and nuns because they want enlightenment, they want to go deeper. And so we're always looking in the wrong place. To go deeper, you can't go anywhere, you have to stay where you are. And the moment deepens by itself. But all aspirations, all wanting, all movement onto something takes you in the opposite direction to enlightenment. It actually agitates your mind. So we just want to make it more and more still. And of course, whenever you do anything, whenever you want anything, whenever you aspire to anything in these parts of the meditation practice, it just disturbs the whole process. So instead you just are still, and you're content with that stillness. You're not wanting anything. You're not waiting for something to happen. You're not, you know, thinking how many more minutes before the nimitta comes up. All those sorts of ideas and thoughts and aspirations, they are the problem. Don't have a schedule. When the retreat center is finished, it's finished. When you're finished, it's finished. But don't go planning and making it happen. Meditation is not like a business. This is not another sort of thing you do in the world. This is a thing which ends the world. So be very careful there. What usually happens in the path of meditation? You start meditating, or you just become a monk or a nun, and you get a degree of stillness, a degree of silence, and it feels right. That's an insight, this intuition that this is going in the right direction. I even remember as a kid feeling these moments of stillness. Not much stillness, the fact that I didn't have anything to do. I remember one of the first days when I really enjoyed myself, just a memory when I was about a 13-year-old, just finishing all my homework early and having an afternoon off school, having nothing to do. And that was a very beautiful experience. I'd had no work to do, no place to go, no lessons to attend. I remember that sort of time. It was like a time of freedom because I wasn't restricted anymore by schedules. I was free. I remember why I felt like that, because there was nothing pushing craving. So I could go any way I wanted to, do whatever I wanted, or do nothing. Spent most of the day just doing nothing. It's a wonderful thing to be able to recognize when the doer, when the craving starts to stop. It gives a sense of meaning, peace. It gives a taste of even enlightenment, even at that time. Craving is a source of suffering. The end of craving is enlightenment. So you're actually seeing this. And as you develop your meditation practice, your monastic life more and more, now you actually start to see the more that you try and achieve, the more messed up you get in your head. So instead we try for stillness, for peace, for calm, for letting go of craving, not creating more craving. As we go deeper into those stillnesses, we always do come across these blocks which stop us getting into deeper stillnesses, and that's all this doing business. And sometimes it gets just a pain trying to sort of stop things, because every time you try and stop this doer, you find it keeps on getting stronger because you are doing the stopping. And this is a very subtle point, but I keep hammering away at it. You don't look at what you're doing outside, you look at the person who's doing it all, the one who's trying to stop things. And that's the one which needs to be stopped. The one inside, the center of things, that's where the calm should be focused. And little by little, you know, you start to be able to calm the doer. Little by little, as you're calming this doer more and more, the more you find that you are disappearing. That's why when you do get into still states of meditation, you have the experience, you're not there. It's not me anymore. Because one of the signs of a self is doing something. Just as the Buddha said, I think this was, where was it, the Mahanidana Sutta, where he said that, you know, like a log, it doesn't do anything, so you know, it can't be a self. So the idea of a self, of a living being, is something which moves, which reacts. So if you're absolutely still, it's as if you're dead. That's what sometimes it feels like in the deep meditations. I remember one of the deep meditations I had as a young monk in Thailand. I was sitting there for a few hours, but it was on the one prayer night. I always remember that because it was on my birthday. What year was that? I was 4 years as a monk, so that would be my 27th birthday. Yeah, that's what it was. Having a nice meditation at all night in the hall of Wat Nanachat. And afterwards, you know, the monk sitting next to me said, the lay people were looking at you and they thought you were dead. And I laughed at that. And I thought afterwards, actually, they were quite right in a sense. Because you're getting very still, you weren't doing anything. So you were like a dead person. And those lay people, they picked it up. So sometimes that's what it's like when you stop and you become very still. You become like a dead person. A lot of people get scared of that because of their attachment to life and the self and being. But take it on trust for me. It's beautiful when you get still. The quieter you are, the stiller you are, the more beauty, the more meaning, the more fun, the more joy. So after a while you become a connoisseur of stillness. And just see how still you can make this doer. And the more still you make the doer, the deeper you get into the meditations. And you get these incredible states when nothing moves. And because things don't move, when things don't move, they disappear. From stillness we get fading away. We get viraga. And that particular fading away, because the senses, we only know stillness. That's why the sutta we just chanted, the fire sermon. Now the senses are on fire. You know what a fire is like? It's always flickering, leaping from place to place. A flame is never still. Even the heater behind me, always flickering, fluttering. But when that fire goes out, then it becomes this stillness. When the six senses aren't on fire with greed, with hatred, with delusion, with doing things and wanting to do things, that's when the fire gets quelled. When that fire gets quelled, you notice that fire is quelled because everything becomes very still and very silent, and then things start to fade away and disappear. When you're still inside, when the consciousness becomes still, then the objects of consciousness, those are the ones which start to disappear first of all. It's from the inner stillness, the outer things disappear afterwards. There's a little bit of a time lag. So when the mind is very still, you keep it still, just wait, and all those other sort of disturbances outside, then they will start to fade away and disappear. When this observer, the mindfulness becomes still, then the breath afterwards becomes still. You have to be still first of all, then the objects you watch become still afterwards. And after the breath becomes still, then it becomes very beautiful. As it fades away, it becomes more refined, the coarser things start to disappear, and the fine, refined, beautiful breath, the delightful breath starts to happen. Don't move, don't try and do anything. Keep the focus on the stillness of the observer. And after a while, be patient. Then even the breath, beautiful breath, disappears. Everything starts to fade away, and that's basically what meditation is, the disappearing act. The body fades away, sounds fades away, the breath disappears. And then what happens next? Oh, you get all sorts of interesting mind states, nimittas, or maybe nothing at first of all. Don't worry, the nothingness will fade away after a while. Just don't move. Just stay there. Stillness should be the main objective. It becomes a skill. In the same way that people learn how to keep their bodies still, I know all of you just sitting, listening to a talk for an hour and being still. You know, some lay people, they just can't believe that you can do this because they're always moving around. They can't sit still for a moment, even if they're looking at the TV. So you've got the bodily stillness, and how do you do that? You can actually transfer that same attitude of mind which keeps the body still to keeping the mind still. And you can't hold the body still. Anyone who tries to hold the body still, it gets very tense and very sore. You just let the body be still. You put your attention somewhere else and the body is still all by itself. Same with the mind. You let the mind become still. And the more this mind becomes still, you get the feeling for how to still the mind. It's a skill which a person learns in the same way they learn how to lay bricks or do carpentry or to paint or to play music. You learn the skill of stillness. So you can just look at the mind and just let it go still very quickly. Of all the skills you can perfect in your life, mental stillness is the most beneficial. If that's all you learn, if that's what you learn, you're way, way ahead on the path. And you're also so peaceful and so happy. Learn how to make the mind still. Feel stillness. Like most learning, you use the feedback mechanism, you know, that you do something, or rather it's a stopping. And then you feel the stillness get more solid, more deep. You know you've gone in the right direction. If the mind moves and the stillness gets less, you know you've gone in the wrong direction. So just by a little bit of trial and error and seeing the results of what happens, you soon learn just how to make this mind more and more still. And the more still it gets, the more profound the meditation, the more deep it is, and the more Dhamma you see. And all these teachings of Buddhism, you understand them for a change. It's not just theories and quoting from suttas. You're actually seeing where the suttas are coming from. Now, why the Buddha sort of got enlightened under the tree? You're experiencing it. Now, why the five senses are on, or the six senses are on fire? What that sermon we just chanted means? What do you mean on fire? You can feel it. You know it. You quell it. You put the fire out temporarily by being still, but the flame doesn't move anymore. Doesn't flicker. It goes out. The body just disappears. Sounds disappear. Thoughts are gone. Thoughts are just such a stupid thing to rely upon. One of the great sayings of the Buddha, which I love repeating, whatever you imagine it to be, it is always something else. Don't rely on your perceptions or your thoughts. Never think you're right, no matter what it is. They're just thoughts and perceptions. Best to let them all go and be still and don't think at all. Know, but don't go conceptualizing. All thoughts miss the point. They're just approximations to truth. They're only half or a fraction of what's really out there. That's why it's wonderful when you get still to see thinking disappear. You know just what a con artist thinking was, and how it deluded you, and how it sort of promised you that it will give you understanding of things, but all that thinking, conceptualizing did was actually to hide the truth from you. It's a silent person who's a sage, not the thinker. So when we allow the thinking to fade away, because the mind is very still, oh, you get so much peace and so much happiness. It is the relief. In Ajahn Chah's simile, I think it's in the suttas somewhere, of a person born with the rope tied around their neck, pulled by two demons. You can actually change the simile to five demons if it's the five senses, or two demons with greed and ill will. Whatever it is, two demons who have been pulling this rope tight ever since you were born. So you take it for granted. You're just used to it. This is normal. So you never notice the suffering of it. And one day those demons, they take a break, they loosen the rope for the first time in your life, and you can breathe at last. That's what it's like, say, when thinking disappears and you're silent. It's like the mind can breathe at last. It's not choked by these ideas and concepts. You're free. You know, you feel, without giving anything a name. And you don't try and capture things with ideas. You just let everything go, fade, disappear. So much freedom when these things stop. And also, when you have those experiences, you never trust your thoughts ever again. If you really have the insights, you're just the thought and opinion, just a way of looking at things. So, but you don't trust it as much as being truth, so it's not worth arguing over. Instead, one trusts in the stillness as being far more real. When one experiences that degree of stillness, it means you're a much more harmonious person. You don't tend to get upset at things. Oh, it's just thoughts. Why just... Even it might feel a right thought, amazing thought, but still it's your thought. It's part of you and the self and sufferings. Oh, let it go. If you can do that much, you're understanding how to translate the stillness into insight. And you go deeper into that stillness. Allow this old body to disappear. And the mind becomes very still. It's amazing just how things vanish. You're sitting there deep in your mind. Your cave disappears, your body disappears. You have no perception of that anymore. And again, it's just another huge relief. Something which has been a big burden, like the rucksack on your back. You're taking it down, you put it aside so you can rest. And sometimes people have been born with that rucksack, that backpack on their back, and they carry it around incessantly ever since they were born. They never put it down once. And now, because of stillness, it's faded away, it's been put down. Oh, what a relief. These are the happinesses of meditation. It's relief. Oh, thank goodness, at last I'm free. And I never realized I was holding this burden for such a long time, all my life, for many lives, the burden of a body and five senses. So wonderful just to be able to drop them. Five senses, they suck. Seeing things, smelling things, having to eat and taste things. Some people really get into eating and thinking, oh, it's really nice having this taste and that taste. But, oh, you know, it's just that fade and just like a plop in the, a raindrop in the puddle. It doesn't last very long. That's why one of the practices of Ajahn Chah was, when you're sort of eating something, get your favorite food, put it in your mouth and keep chewing it, and chewing it, and chewing it, and chewing it, until all the taste is gone. And then keep chewing it, and 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 chewing it. And chewing it. What am I doing this for? Just the taste business is just doesn't last all that long. So whatever, anyway. That when one can allow those things to go, it's so much more peaceful. That's one of the nice things about going on retreat. Somebody else puts the food in your bowl. It's so nice not having to worry about what to put in your bowl. There's just one less thing you have to be concerned and worried about. So as you to learn how to just to relax this rope, this put down the burdens, lower the rucksack of these senses, just through stillness, it just disappears by itself. You can't do it. You just got to cultivate the calm stillness. And you're just a witness. You don't do anything. Just watch all these things fade away because you're not moving. If you move, you create them. If you're still, they disappear. When they disappear, you understand a little bit about what freedom is. The more still you are, the more you hold this door in check, and the more skillful you are of letting it be, in other words, letting it disappear and not doing anything, the more this whole world vanishes and disappears. And thinking disappears, the senses disappear, and then you get these jhanas, beautiful states of stillness. When you have anything like that, oh, it's just you understand what Buddhism is all about. You understand it's about freedom, about letting go of the self. Because when the doer is gone, half of you has disappeared. You vanish in those states. Not completely. You all know that the next thing which vanishes, just through stillness, you don't do anything, it happens by itself, is the knower, the consciousness. The whole thing vanishes and disappears. And as you more deep you get, it's incredible and weird, the more you understand what happiness truly is. Happiness is being free of things, of things ending, of things stopping. You realize that we've always sought happiness in starting things, in creating things, in making things happen. We really thought that you make happiness, you create happiness. But you find the more you interfere with the world, you just create more problems, not happiness. The more you let go and stand back, the more peace and happiness you create. So you become someone who treads lightly in the world, who speaks gently, because you don't want to disturb the peace of the world. The more you do, the more you act, the more problems you cause. So you become so passive, silent. It's not being irresponsible, it's becoming a Buddhist, becoming a holy one, someone who leaves the world. If you can do things like that, then you're really getting somewhere on this path. And you're inspiring others, not with your words, but with your example. It's examples which we need, especially in the Western world. There are so many teachers, there are so many books and so many words. But you know, we always want to find someone who's actually doing it. We want to find the examples, you know, the peaceful, calm, wise people. So it's the example which we need, not more teachers, not more words. And if one can aspire for that, all you need to do is to sit down and shut up, to be still, and to cultivate stillness, and to make that your goal in your life. See how still you can be. And sometimes even when things around the sort of people who are getting busy or arguing or talking a lot, you can still be that still person when everything around is moving. And I think that's maybe what Ajahn Chah meant by that phrase, still water flowing. So the world moves, but you're inside absolutely still. You're not moving with the world. You're still, and the world, you know, like a rock in the middle of the stream, it moves around you, but you stay solid, unmovable. If you can do things like that, you understand what this path is all about. And the more you get really into the still mind states, just from that perspective, you understand just what movement is all about. You understand the world, not by being in the world, in the same way that you can't get perspective when you're right in the middle of the jungle. You've got to find that tower or that mountain which is above and beyond the jungle, and then you can look down upon it and you can understand how it all works. You've got to get out of things, beyond things, to get perspective on them. It's the same way, it's in the still states of mind where you're outside of the world, literally. Only from there you get perspective and insight of what the world truly is and what people are doing and why they're doing it and how you should relate to all of this. It's a stillness where insight comes, not through thinking, not through contemplating, but by stilling the mind, being peaceful. Not only that, not only you get insight, you get enormous amounts of energy. And that energy, you know, sometimes we all get tired and worn out. And sometimes when you get tired and worn out, it's just through tiredness, we say things we shouldn't say, we do things we shouldn't do. Just because we're worn out. So be able to still the mind and get energy up. It's not only for insight, but it's also for virtue. It's much easier to keep your precepts. It's much easier to be kind after you've been in very deep still states. It's basically the hindrances, the defilements have been subdued for a while. Not through willpower, but through wisdom power. And because they've been seen, You remember that for a long time. Why should I get angry and upset? What am I doing that for? It doesn't help them, doesn't help me. So you just don't do it. Not out of control, just nature. The more that you are in stillness, what do I want to go around being so greedy for? What do I want to do anything for? What do I need? What do I want? I don't want anything. I just want peace. I want stillness. I want to still the wanting. And when you understand that, all the virtue just becomes natural, becomes pure, not coming because you're trying to follow some rules or follow some code. It's because the cause of the lack of virtue, this doer, this wanting, this ego, this control freak. You want to control it one way, someone wants to control it another way, the nature of the world is another way, and you're always in conflict. It's amazing how many people, if they're not in conflict with others, they're in conflict with themselves, or they're in conflict with the world. It's crazy fighting the world. So instead we just make peace with things. We're still. We understand what that stillness is through experience. Because of those experiences which were repeated so many times in our lives, they become part of the way we relate to people, we relate to the world outside of meditation. In the same way we just learn how to flow with things, not fight them, make peace with them, be kind, be gentle to our mind in meditation so we can become still. We can become very kind and gentle to people and things in the world. So, you know, by being kind and gentle to the workers at the retreat center, you feel they want to work harder for me. And so they respect you. They want to do something beautiful for you. Not because you shout at them like the builder does. Because you're kind to them, you understand them. Motivation. You get much more out of people by motivating them than by shouting at them. It's just basic psychology. So as I lead the monastery, that's how I train my mind as well. I'm kind to my mind. I never shout at my mind. I never bawl it out and say what a stupid mind you are. I never sort of teach it and tell it what to do. I just understand it, make peace with it, be kind to it, be gentle. And the mind becomes just so soft, so still, that it responds. So I have a wonderful relationship with my mind. So much so that it's easy to get peaceful and easy to get still. And having 2 weeks of that, it's just, you really want to share it. Well, that's the gift you want to give to everybody else. And to be able to, for you also, to be able to taste that sort of that bliss and that peacefulness and that stillness. But some of you can. What a wonderful thing it is to be still, to be peaceful, to be able to sit like a Buddha sat. Like all these other great monks and nuns over the centuries, to sit in the same place. Just before I came out here, bowing in my kuti to my shrine, there's some pictures on there, which I just noticed, of the boar cave on the vulture's peak, you know, where Venerable Sariputta became an arahat. There's the other caves underneath the vulture's peak. And when I saw those, I just remembered those times you've been there yourself and just meditated in the cave where Sariputta became enlightened, or meditated in the cave just under the vulture's peak where the Buddha would have meditated. I think, wow, to be able to do that, to actually to cross your legs and put your bottom on a rock where you're 100% sure the Buddha once put his bottom and crossed his leg. Wow, that's really cool. That's awesome. So, you know, it's very easy to get nice meditation in those places. You just, wow, this is good. But it's not just that. It's much better to be able to go into those deep meditations, because that's where the Buddha lived. Then remember what I said some years ago? For those of you who haven't been to India yet to see the four holy places, the four holy places are not Lumbini, Bodh Gaya, Sarnath and Kusinara. That's the external four holy places. The real four holy places of Buddhism are first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's the pilgrimage which you should make, to sit where the Buddha sat, in his incredible, peaceful, still states of mind. You can't reach those pilgrimage sites by going anywhere. Any journeying takes you away from where the Buddha sat. Any controlling, any wanting moves you out from where the Buddha lived. All you need to do is stop all of that. Go in the opposite direction, against the stream of craving, against this doing, against this controlling, against where your sense of self wants to take you. You go in the opposite direction. You go inwards, never onwards. When you stop travelling, that's when you arrive at the goal. The stillness, the quietness, the peace. That's where the Buddha lived. And that's where you can go and visit at any time. You just taste one of those places. And that is awesome, with a capital A. That really, so wow, you can do that. And that's why you get so much inspiration, so much energy. And don't think you can't do this. That's Mara speaking. All you need to do is nothing. That's why one of the greatest similes I've given is the simile of the man walking up and down the side of the river, looking for a bridge or a boat to go across to the other side. And they always go up or down, up or down, up or down. All they really need to do, they don't realize it's not a very wide river, they can just step across. So you don't need to look for a boat, you don't need to look for a bridge. The river is not wide, but you have to go perpendicular to your usual directions of going up and down. That's what meditation is, just going a different direction than you're used to. Doing something not the same way you've always been doing other things. You go perpendicular to doing. Going up is craving, going down is negativity. Doing something different for a change. Nothing. Which is going across. Perpendicular in a completely different direction to what you're used to. And it's weird to try and do something like that, but after a while you get the hang of it, and you realize that's how you get enlightened. Isn't you not that far away, just a step. But you can spend all your life going up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. Until one day you get the message, something clicks, and you realize the whole thing has been done the wrong way. You've been trying. You've been aspiring, working, controlling, trying to get something, trying to do something. When you stop doing, you stop that controlling, I mean you really stop it, you really are going in another direction. It's incredible just how fast and how powerful things happen. When you stop, you just bliss comes up, stillness gets deeper. As long as you carry on in that weird, strange direction. You don't interfere. If you're going to let go, do it properly, 100%. Don't do anything. When you can quell that dua, that chaitanya, that sankhara, that's what the Buddha called it, sabba sankhara samatha, calming all the sankharas, all the doing. It's amazing just to see the whole world, that which you knew, fade away and disappear. All the familiar territory of your mind or your life vanish. And that's real great insight. Because with it vanishes suffering and all dukkha. So you're getting into the real beautiful mystical insight, wise states. And this is actually makes a whole monastic life worthwhile. You understand why the Buddha sat under the tree and started teaching the Dhamma. He said people have got a lot of dust in their eyes. They've just got too much passion for doing things. Because of that, they find it hard to understand what a word like Sabbasankara Samatha actually means. Calming all doing? What does that mean? And so they start to try and do the calming. They just miss the whole thing. You understand what he means there? Wow, it's not that hard to do. It's just the understanding, the wisdom part has to be the important ingredient. So you all got more than enough effort, more than enough motivation, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Just that last bit of wisdom thing. Seeing the right direction. Not the usual direction, but something which is quite weird and strange to you. When you can do something like that, and when you do it, you feel it straight away, as I say. The rope loosens. The backpack just drops from your shoulders. You feel loose, you feel free. Rushes of piti sukha, deep stillness, profound, wow, this is what happens afterwards. Wow, what's that? Wow, this is really nice. Whoa, yeah. It comes afterwards, because that's just the only way, that's the way you're used to describing those states. You know, you've got to use some words, and that's just our modern language. But sort of, you know, in there, this is what you're experiencing. This is not just for fun. This is for liberation. This is freedom. This is what this thing's all about. You just get a few of those. Wow. It's worth all the years you've practiced as a nun or as a monk or as an anagarika. It's all the time you've come and given food to the monastery or cleaned the toilets or driven people backwards and forwards and all the arguments and struggle. Oh, it was all worthwhile. Thank you so much. Just have the chance of doing this. It's one moment of freedom, the real freedom. It's just worth more than a king's ransom. Over a bunch of kings, maybe not the king, maybe the Sultan of Dubai's ransom or whatever. More than the cost of, I just read the other day in the newspaper that someone else has bought Manchester City Football Club. More than Manchester City Football Club. Or more than all the money in the world. Just one moment of freedom. Real stillness. Just taste the Dhamma. And just a wonderful thing like that. Just the whole hundreds of lives become worthwhile. So now you know what to do. How to do it. So I've got to keep talking in the same way. Or a little bit this way, a little bit that way every time until eventually the message gets home. And you understand just, you know, how to meditate, how to be still, how to be peaceful. Stillness. Contentment. Emptiness, freedom, liberation. See if you can do that. Once you do it once, you realize it's not so hard. If you haven't done it yet, it's impossibly hard. Sometimes it's just some faith. Keep on going. Eventually, something happens. And then you understand what the Buddha said the taste of freedom truly is like. So, I taught whatever I could. Now it's all up to you.
Sūpaṭipanno vā